The Ashmolean today doesn't present itself as a museum of science in any way, but the truth is that for the first 200 or so years of its existence, it was very much centered on the scientific, on scientific research. Now, the collection with which it was founded, if you may recall, was that of the Tradescant family. They put together their collection, which was eventually opened to the museum as a publicly accessible resource. It was collected very much in the context of the early 17th century cabinets of curiosities. So they had a large collection, large enough, as I say, to be eventually opened to the fee-paying public at Lambeth in South London, as it's described. And but really gathered together on principles which are difficult sometimes for us to penetrate today. They have nothing to do with the sort of conventional academic pursuits that we are more familiar with. This was to do with the culture of curiosity. So what they were interested in was the biggest, the grandest, the most rare, the most outlandish. And so it doesn't sound like a very promising foundation for a museum of science, but by the time this collection was inherited in the 1680s by Elias Ashmole, although it had not itself changed its constitution, it had become sufficiently extensive to attract the sort of proto-academic community in London. So you have people like, for example, John Ray going there when he was undertaking his revision of Francis Willoughby's Ornithology in order to view the specimens of birds, which could not then be seen anywhere else in London. So that it was already beginning to function in some way as an academic resource. For complicated reasons, which needn't concern us, the collection eventually passed to Elias Ashmole, a founder fellow of the Royal Society, and a herald, and a historian. Well, he's the historian of the Order of the Garter, a numismatist, a lawyer by profession, who had some connection with the University of Oxford. While he was working for the Customs and Excise, he had visited Oxford. He'd been here during the Civil War and took part in the defense of the sort of Magdalen Bridge area. He was a gentleman of the artillery down there. And he did a bit of studying in the Bodleian, certainly, while he was here, but he never matriculated nor graduated. And in his later years, he had undertaken the cataloguing of the Bodleian Library's collection of coins, for which the university rewarded him with a DSC. So this was the basis for his association with the university. And when he inherited the Tradescant collection, he undertook to deliver it to the museum, to the university, and it was very much, by that time, he had no personal interest in the culture of curiosity, but it was as a scientific resource which that came to Oxford. And he makes that clear in the statutes that he drew up in 1683, when the museum first opened, 21st of May. And this is what he wrote: "Because the knowledge of nature is very necessary to human life, health, and the conveniences thereof, and because that knowledge cannot be so well and usefully attained except the history of nature be known and considered, I, Elias Ashmole, out of my affection for this sort of learning, have amassed together great variety of natural concretes and bodies and bestowed them on the University of Oxford." So no mention incidentally of the Tradescants, but certainly no mention of the biggest or the grandest or whatever. This is supposed to be a functioning collection. And the institution which he founded was a tripartite one in the old Ashmolean building, now the Museum of the History of Science, where the top floor was taken up by the museum, the ground floor was the School of Natural History, and the basement was a chemistry laboratory, all functioning as one integrated institution and all under the direction of Robert Plott, the university's first professor of chemistry. And it seems for a while that the museum did in fact begin to function in the way that Ashmole had anticipated. Plott gave his lectures in the ground floor. The scientific experiments went on in the basement, and indeed it was a kind of realization of an ideal that goes back to Francis Bacon, really, who had this wonderful imaginative idea of a college in which the scholars would live, very much as they would later come to do in Oxford, but where they would live in a sort of community dedicated to scientific research, which would have amongst its other the facilities a museum, a laboratory, a garden, and that sort of thing. And the Ashmolean really is the first proper realization of that ideal. I should say that the Royal Society had been founded 20-odd years before the Ashmolean itself was opened, and that too had a museum, its repository as it was called, under the control of its curator of experiments. And indeed in Oxford there was founded in the 1650s under the inspiration of the then Warden of Wadham, a philosophical society which was in communication with the Royal Society. They exchanged information, they carried out their own experiments and so on, and Plott and his deputy, Edward Lewid, were both members of that society. So the museum was locked into the very center of scientific discourse of its day. Almost straight away, things began to fall apart slightly, as Ashmole failed, as he had promised or undertaken to do originally, to found a chair which would be associated with the museum. And quite quickly, the various components began to go their own way. The museum became rather a public place of resort, as it still is, but became to some degree separated from the other activities which were going on in the same building. And the responsibility for the museum started off for the first two successive appointments. The curator was still the curator of the whole institution, but after that they went their own way. And this was very much to the detriment, I should say, of the museum proper, the museum in the sense of the collection, because whilst the laboratory and the natural history school both carried on as fairly vibrant institutions, the museum collections began to stagnate somewhat. And in the course of the first half of the 18th century, there's very little activity of any sort that can be deemed scientific or indeed anything else. There's very little evidence of much activity at all. And the situation reached its low point, I think, with the appointment of George Huddesford, who was the president of Trinity College, as holding in plurality, as it were, the keepership of the Ashmolean. And as one contemporary puts it, he put in a scholar at £5 or something to look after the collections and said, no, you get on with it. And his final, Huddersfield's final act of nepotism was to appoint his 23-year-old son as his successor, and one could almost hear the final nail being driven into the coffin of the Ashmolean at that point. But fortunately, William Huddersfield, the son, turned out to be an absolutely model curator, and who turned around the whole museum. So from about the 1750s, things began to pick up again. William Huddersfield inherited what someone describes as a confused heap of natural bodies in the Ashmolean. He began to reorder it. He recatalogued the whole collection. He had in mind to redisplay the entire museum according to the Linnaean system, which was very advanced. This was still before the British Museum had appointed Sir Lander, one of Linnaeus's pupils, to do exactly that with parts of their natural history collection. So had this come to fruition, we would have been once again right at the forefront of scientific thinking in the middle of the 18th century. Unfortunately, William Huddersfield died young and was therefore unable to see through the reforms which he had in mind. And I'm afraid to say that for the rest of the 17th century, 18th century, the museum continues in a long slide into fairly pretty much irrelevance. And it's only really with the beginnings in the early 19th century of when you have people like Buckland appointed to be the first reader in geology, I think he was, and Daubeny and people like that working in the scientific, greater scientific community in Oxford, that the museum begins to pick up again. But it also proves to be a slightly two-edged sword, or if that's not mixing metaphors, because while people like Buckland became very interested in the natural history collection, particularly the mineralogy collections, his response was to not to build them up in the public domain, as it were, but to have them all shipped to his own study, which was in the Clarendon building next door. So that, in the first place, disappears from the museum collection. And this begins a process which reaches its culmination when the new Natural Science Museum, now the University Museum of Natural History, opened in 1860, when not only the mineralogical collections, but all the zoological collections as well, are transferred from the museum, from the Ashmolean, to the new museum. So, in a sense, this marks the death knell of the scientific era of the Ashmolean. Before we get to that point, though, it does go through an interesting, if not entirely scientific, phase when, in the 1830s, in 1826, in fact, John Shute Duncan is appointed as the keeper. He's actually replaced 5 years later by his brother, Philip Duncan, but it's one, we sort of regard them as one seamless curatorship because they one continued the program initiated by the other. And the Duncans' principal aim for the natural history collections, and that's really all they were interested in, was to use it as a means of expounding on the theories of the Reverend William Paley, who was an exponent of natural theology, and there the whole of the museum was rearranged from the late 1820s onwards as a museum in which the first principal aim of the museum was to display evidences of the curator in the natural world. So having got this new emphasis on the natural history collections, they're in fact slightly subverted because they are, although they are showing themes like locomotion and sight and so on, they're showing them for a very specific doctrinaire reason. And so the museum then is, and we still not have all the labels, but we have a number of the very extensive labels which the Duncans prepared in order to accompany their collection and which set out the various aims that they are trying to demonstrate with particular parts of the collection. This, as I say, gets us up to about 1850 or so, when a new curator is appointed, a chap called Phillips, and whose principal duty is to set up the new Museum of Natural History. And at that point, all of the natural history specimens disappear from the Ashmolean. The later 19th century, it gets worse and worse as the new Pitt Rivers Museum opens. All of the ethnographic material is withdrawn from the Ashmolean as well, and somewhere along the way all of the coins and medals from the museum are moved into the Bodleian Library. And so what we're left with is really a sort of antiquarian rump which had very little relevance to the wider museum community, or the university community, I should say. But nonetheless, it formed the basis on which two later curators, John Henry Parker, who was part of the, some of you may know, you won't remember, Parker's Bookshop, which was in where the sort of poster shop now for Blackwell's is. They were a publishing family here in Oxford and booksellers. He offered himself at the age of 60-something as the curator, and I think he decided he would forego his salary, but he wanted the opportunity to build up this antiquarian dimension of the museum, which he began to do really rather well, but he was then superseded by Arthur Evans, who was the person who really at this time, went on, as you know, to become the excavator of Knossos, his principal achievement. At this time, he was still quite a young and vigorous man. He set about really establishing the place on an entirely new archaeological basis. And not to dwell on him overmuch, he involved the collector C.D.E. Fortnum, who's a London-based collector, got him interested in the museum, and between them they cooked up a means of approaching the university so that the university would build a new museum to house these collections. This is the museum that has just been demolished and replaced by the redevelopment at the Ashmolean, so it was everything behind the neoclassical facade. And it was under those circumstances that in 1897 the Ashmolean Museum moved out of its original building and into the structure adjoining what was then the university picture galleries, and the two institutions formally merged in 1908 to become the Ashmolean Museum of Art and Archaeology. So by that time, I think it would probably be unfair to say that the Ashmolean had long since lost its scientific impetus, because many of my colleagues who are irked at being still in the Department of Antiquities rather than the Department of Archaeology very much see themselves as part of a continuing scientific community rather than a kind of dilettante antiquarian one. But by that time, the Ashmolean's contribution to formal science, and it was very much throughout the whole period natural science that we're talking about, had ceased to be. Thank you.